This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Joanna Nell, welcome to Better Reading.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, it is the festive season, so Joanna and I have both got a glass of champagne. So excuse us if the conversation goes one way or the other. Okay, so Joanna is a British-Australian writer. She's also a GP, an advocate for positive ageing. Oh, I didn't know that.
An accidental advocate, I would say.
Her essays and short fiction have won multiple awards and been widely published in magazines, journals and literary anthologies. Her first four novels were national bestsellers, and now with her latest novel, Mrs. Winterbottom Takes a Gap Year, Joanna explores retirement, mismatched expectations and living the life in the moment. Gosh, it's so timely.
Yes, a lot of people are saying that. I think I sort of hit the zeitgeist of maybe a lot of people are thinking about retirement.
Mm-mm. Do you know, I always thought my approach to retirement was going to be kicking and screaming. But I think biology kind of steps up in a way, or steps in, if you like, and you kind of just go with it. And the more I think about it, the more it sounds more attractive to me.
But I think that the days of the traditional retirement, you know, where we worked up to 65, was now 67, and then you put your feet up and you got your pension, and pretty much that was it. I think that that's gone. And I think that some people are looking to retire earlier in their careers, maybe in their 50s. Some people are still going at 80 and have no intention of retiring. So
Joe Biden.
Yeah. So I think that the whole concept of retirement as just a sort of a stepping back and a withdrawal from life is really an outdated one. And people are just maybe looking at it as a time of transition into another phase, another exciting chapter of their lives.
Yeah, and I also think it's cultural. I mean, I think Americans aren't as wedded to retirements as we have been here, to retirement. They really, I don't think, have had a set age over the years, from what I know anyway. So, because, you know, very often, like if you're flying a US airline or any service, the stewards can be of any age, whereas, you know, like with other airlines, you know, people are only in their 30s. So I feel as though they've had a different attitude culturally than to what we've had. But I think also too, it's an affluence thing. It's related to money, isn't it?
Well, that's right. And I think that we do focus a lot on you know, paying off the mortgage and getting enough super. But it's almost like the finish line is moving further and further away for a lot
that's
of people. And,
yeah.
And it may be that a lot of people who can't afford to retire are working later into life. And so, yeah, definitely finances come into it.
And I think too, I've got a theory that I'm excited for young people. I'm excited about the next generation of young people. I see them engage in social justice issues, in climate change, and I get really excited about their attitudes. And then I'm noticing more and more that people, older people, people my age, for instance, are still out there. The ageist thing, that's where I'm going with that, is kind of diminishing a little bit, or is that just me?
No, I would hope so. I think ageism is one of those almost invisible isms, if you like. You know, we've sort of kicked all those other kinds of discrimination, whether it be on gender, race, or whatever. I think that ageism is almost an invisible discrimination where, you know, it's almost internalised as well. We're often not aware that we're ageist ourselves, you know, when we say, oh, I can't do that because of my age, or it's not age appropriate. And I think it works both ways. I think that younger people can look at older people and, you know, and have certain preconceptions about older people. But it also works the other way, doesn't it?
It does.
So older people looking at, at younger people and you know, having a certain assertions about what young people are like. So hopefully in the future, we'll manage to break down those barriers as well.
I was at the pool only yesterday with my great-nephew, who's 10. We were playing this game where you dive down at the bottom and get a toy. Whoa, very, very hard for me, right? And after 10 or 15 minutes, I was like, oh, God, I can't do this anymore. And I said to him, you know, why don't you play with somebody else? So, you know, of course, kids make friends so quickly, so he's playing with somebody else. And I heard him say to the other child, oh, yeah, she's tired. She's 38. And I thought, oh, my God.
What, but you are 38, aren't you?
To be 38 again. Yeah, but it was the perception, I guess, too, of him looking up and thinking, well, you know, really 38, 59, 60, it's all the same to him at the age of 10.
I don't think I'd want to be 38. No, I certainly wouldn't want to be 28 or 18 again. I think, you know, once I hit 50, I'm 57 now, that, you know, life sort of opened up for me. I think you're so full of confidence or more confidence than were before, and you sort of draw on all those life lessons that you've learned. So, no, I certainly don't hanker to be younger anymore.
I remember I had a really good friend who died at 49 from lung cancer and short of her 50th birthday. And so I decided to go big time with my 50th. Mm. I really went big, and I had a big sit-down party in the park. Like, it was 60 people sit down, and it was so beautiful. And the caterer said to me, I've never seen anyone so happy about turning 50. Mm. Well, you are when you start losing your friends. Mm. Yeah.
No, that can be a real wake-up call, can't it?
It was a real wake-up
call. And I think once you get to that stage of life and you can see that what's ahead of you may not be as much as what you already have behind you, I think you start to value life and live more in the present and worry, you know, sweat the little things less and less.
And I used to hear, I don't know if you hear this as well, Joanna, but I used to hear people say, oh, you know, I feel invisible, like people around my age, or I don't know, for some reason, maybe because I'm not attuned to it, or I don't feel invisible at all.
I think you can allow yourself to be seen as invisible. I mean, I don't mind being invisible when I nip down to the local shop in my Ugg boots. But I think it's about speaking up and making yourself seen and heard, and, you know, sort of not maybe allowing yourself to shrink into the background, you know, in sort of wearing camouflage clothes to blend in. I think it's having the confidence to step forward and say, hello, I'm here. And,
step forward and step up. Yeah. Like, don't lose what it is you stand for. Don't lose what it is that's made you tick. Don't lose. Yeah, I think it's all about that. I am often surprised sometimes if I get on a bus or a train and someone stands up for me. I thought, I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, that can be a bit confronting, especially when you don't look pregnant. You think, oh, okay.
Okay, it's an age thing. All right, so tell me, when you're writing a book like this, I mean, I think there's a lot of humour in it. You have to be self-deprecating, I guess. But you're also bringing humour into what is, you know, a really big topic. Talk to me about that process of writing.
The humour, I think, has become part of my natural writing voice. I think when I started out, I tried to write in a very literary voice, as we all do, and it really wasn't me. I think at heart, I'm sort of more of a light-hearted person. Or having said that, you know, the profession I chose as a doctor is very serious, and we're often dealing with some very difficult and sad times and experiences. But I think I learned to use humour, and when appropriate, and that becomes a feeling for when it's appropriate and when it isn't, to sort of maybe soothe a little bit, you know, when you think about, you know, a kid hurting themselves,
right.
you lift them up and you tickle them and you make them laugh, you know, and suddenly the pain goes away a little bit, or it helps as a balm a little bit. So that has just come as partly as a natural thing. I love to laugh, but partly is, you know, it's also a therapeutic thing. I think that, you know, you can, if you can make people feel better by having a little laugh or a giggle, that's, to me, is a sign of a job well done.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Okay, let's go back. Let's go back to where it is you started, why you wanted to study medicine, and how you ended up, I guess, transitioning from being a GP to a writer.
So this goes back to the early 1970s, and I was 8 years old, and I'd watched something on TV the night before, and I think it was a sort of emergency ward 10 or some sort of medical program in the early 70s. And by coincidence, the next day, the teacher went round the class and asked everybody what they wanted to be when they grew up. And, you know, the hands went up for teacher or train driver or football or whatever. And I put my hand up and said I wanted to be a doctor. And this teacher looked horrified, and she sort of and she said, well, that's a job for the boys, really, isn't it?
Wow.
You know, you should set your sights on being a nurse if that's what you wanted to do. And and certainly I had nothing against nursing at all. That would have been a fantastic profession too. But I think the moment somebody told me I couldn't do something, it made me want to do it even more. And so I was determined to sort of prove them wrong. And also I had a bit of an unhealthy interest in the sort of human body. I was always looking at, you know, books in the library and dead animals on the side of the road. So I was sort of fascinated by that, by science. But that sort of took me away from my first love, which was reading. I discovered books. Mum said I taught myself to read before I went to school. So I was hungry for story, and they bought me a typewriter around the same age, about 8 or 9, Mum and Dad, because they could see that I was writing little books and things. And Dad is a bit of an archivist. He should have been a museum curator. He's kept all these things. He's kept the very same typewriter and all my early stories, which is quite a funny thing to look back on, because, of course, they're written by a child. But there's an element almost of the voice in it there, which is really interesting.
I think writing, from being a reader, and I guess being our age, you do grow with an author. Like, I have seen authors, you know, that I've admired, and I don't notice that they're getting older until I start reading the story, and they're about different. Paul Auster. Really comes to mind when I'm thinking about this. Like, you know, because when he wrote, was it New York Stories? I think that was the first one, of when he was really young and on the street and doing this and doing that. And then when he got to, and I can't remember the name of the later book, the most recent one, it was about him being a grandparent. And I feel that there was still him in it, but it's a totally different story, isn't it? So I think if you're writing at 7 or 8 and then you're writing in your 50s, there is your voice.
And I think if somebody had said in a careers talk, you know, you love writing, you're actually quite good at writing stories, maybe you should be a writer. But of course they didn't do that.
No.
So it wasn't something that was encouraged. It was always, you know, magically writers somehow were born like that. And so
I have a fascination with medicine, though. Do you? So you don't mind the sight of blood?
No.
Okay.
Not at all.
Yeah. Or the gooey side of it.
Look, I have a thing about toenails. I'm not awfully keen on toenails and eyes. I don't think I could have ever been an ophthalmologist. But the rest of it, it doesn't bother me.
You.
No, not at all.
And did you enjoy that? Did you enjoy studying and that profession? And tell me, was that back in the UK, and, you know, how that you transitioned from there to here to Australia?
Yes, so I went to Cambridge for my preclinical, and so that was learning all the anatomy and physiology and, you know, a lot of lab work there.
And it's science, isn't
it? It's science. I didn't so much enjoy all that. I was fascinated by the dissection, by the human bodies. We did live dissection, not live, obviously, but real dissection on real bodies at the time. And I found that fascinating. But I found myself always thinking, what's the story? Who is this person? You know, what's their story? How have they come to be lying on this table here? And really, medicine made a lot more sense to me once I went on to the clinical stage, which is I did 3 years at Oxford then. I was very lucky to be at both. And that was 3 years on the wards with real patients. And of
Right,
that's when I really felt I'd sort of found that niche. But it wasn't so much the, you know, the pathology and the diseases, because it used to be that, you know, patient was like the, oh, the, you know, the cellulitis of the leg in bed 10 or whatever. It was always for me the story of that person. Yes. I would spend far too long taking a history from a patient, you know, I'd be told, haven't you finished yet?
I mean, how long did you go out with him for?
I know, but that's just fascinating, you know, and especially the older patients who had a lot of stories. To me, that was, I was taking copious notes, which wasn't required.
And you were here for, what, get your appendix out?
Okay. So I went into general practice, having enjoyed also psychiatry as well. That was sort of quite an eye-opener there. And as a GP, I think you have that relationship with people and you are hearing stories.
GP, yeah,
and I certainly had the what I consider the best years of general practice when I worked in a small village and then again at another practice. We moved to Australia in 2003.
Right.
My husband.
Why?
Well, I don't know. Life was pretty good in the New Forest. I had a job. I was a partner in a GP practice. I had two young children, a 3-year-old and an 8-month-old baby.
Whoa.
Just finished renovating a house, and my husband came home one day and said, oh, the office, he worked for the cruise line at the time in their office, he said, they want me to move to Sydney.
Oh.
And I said, oh, no. I'm just not ready to do that. I travelled a lot, but I wasn't ready to up sticks.
But also that distance. And
the distance, and I know, and I was close to my family, and I had a job, and I loved. But then I remember one day, it was a very sort of rainy day in the middle of winter, it was February day, and I'd been in the house with a three-year-old and an 8-month-old all day. And when my husband came home from work, I said, can we go to Sydney?
Let's get some
Let's
sunshine.
Let's go for a year.
Yeah.
And a year turned into 20 years. And my children have grown up here. And so, still no writing, though. You know, I was sort of working away.
And you worked as a GP here?
Yes, I did. I worked for 10 years in a public hospital emergency department at Mona Vale Hospital.
Right.
Long story, but as an overseas trained doctor, I wasn't allowed to work in anywhere where I billed Medicare, which included general practice. So I worked in a hospital for 10 years, then went into general practice and was a very busy, you know, working mum. A lot of people recognise that. And it was the infamous 10-pin bowling accident that changed everything. It was a get-to-know-the-other-parent evening at my children's new school, and I was under strict instructions not to embarrass them. And to cut a long and painful story short, I did the splits, had to be fireman's lifted out of the place with ruptured hamstrings.
Oh, painful.
So I did embarrass them. I embarrassed myself as well.
Oh.
But I had to lie, I had surgery and I had to lie down for 6 weeks afterwards while this
In
whole thing healed. No, at home on
at
the
home.
Sofa. And so I was lying on my back with my laptop resting on my chest, basically. And I just, it was almost like I had just sort of a little bit of an epiphany. And I thought, well, I've got to this stage of life. I was in my late 40s by then. Like, you know, I've given up all this time for everyone else and my family, which I don't regret, of course. But I thought I'd never done anything for myself. And so I found myself Googling creative writing courses and I found the Australian Writers' Centre and enrolled in a course there. And that's when my writing journey started, quite accidentally.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I wanted just to touch on hospitals as well. I mean, obviously I wasn't a doctor, but I was in hospital recently and I was quite unwell. And my family were really advocating for me to get a private room. It was a public hospital, it was RPA. And I didn't want that because I was in a room of four. And I tell you, the only thing that kept me going were other people's stories. And because people turned over really quickly, they were only there for one or two nights and I was there for 2 weeks, right, I really, really got interested in why people are there. I would watch how many visitors they would get, how many, you know. And so I had, even before I would start speaking to them and introducing myself, I had a story for each one of them. And I thought to be in a room on your own would be so lonely and so boring. To be with other people, I found that really, really helpful in my healing as well. Because then you meet people that are going through something, you know, similar or not, you know.
It's true. And a lot of people make actually very close friendships with people they've been in hospital with. And I think we're at our most vulnerable then, aren't we? And we're already opened up. You know, we're open to the world. There's not much that's private, you know, when you're sharing, you know, you're divided really just by a paper curtain. So I think that there's that tendency too, and to maybe to cling to other people
and to help other people.
Exactly.
And so, because I became the senior person in the room, if you like, because I'd been there
at
so
38,
long.
Yes.
38. But in terms of longevity, I was helping people navigate the system or if they needed to go somewhere and whatever. And again, that gave me something. I needed a distraction. You know, I found that really, really helpful. And I've got to say, second to none care. I mean, the public hospital system here, when it works really, really well.
It's, I mean, shame that it's not as well staffed as it should be, that the staff are you know, but if you can help each other. And
That's right. Okay, so you started writing. Now, it's one thing Googling a creative writing course and another thing writing a book.
Yes. As soon as I enrolled, and at the time it sort of felt like quite a lot of money just to, you know, just to spend on something that was on a whim. But I have to say, and I don't know how else to describe it other than finding a little missing piece of the puzzle. It was like almost falling in love. I just had that instant sensation that this was something I had to do and I needed to do, and I loved it. I was just, my heart was going. We're so excited, even with that very first assignment that I did. I just knew it was the right thing for me. It was tapping into something that was so innate in me that I'd been ignoring for so long, really. And one of the first assignments was to find a character, to put them in a certain setting and to have a dialogue. To, you know, we're talking about dialogue, I think it was. And I was working in aged care at the time, visiting a lot of retirement homes. And I suppose my mind was in that sort of environment. So the character I created was a woman who was about to turn 80, and she was down at her local beach cafe having a coffee with her much racier 80-year-old friend who was persuading her to get back to online dating, well, you know, after she'd lost her husband. And I just loved doing that assignment. In fact, to the point where I turned it into a short story, because I didn't feel I was done with these two characters, and the short story was shortlisted for a prize.
Oh, wow.
And even after that, I still feel I wasn't done with these two characters. They kept sort of coming to me and, you know, waking me up in the middle of the night, chatting. And they were the two characters that I turned into Peggy and Angie in the Single Ladies of Jacaranda Retirement Village, my first novel. So they were with me right from the beginning.
So,
I got so much out of that. And, you know, it took me from the time I enrolled in that first class to publishing my first book was 6 years, which is exactly the same amount of time it took me to trying to be a doctor, because you can't just turn up and write a book.
You can't expect it to be good.
Speaking
of retirement villages and the work that you did around that, I think, again, the perception now more so is changing around those. I think that they're better facilities anyway. Well, not all of them, but a lot of them are. And I think attitudes are changing to how people live their lives there. My mother spent the last part of her life in a nursing home. It was more like a hospital because she had dementia. However, the level of care and the camaraderie and her interactions with the staff were absolutely gorgeous. Really, really beautiful care. When it works well, doesn't it?
It does, and if it can work well, and I suppose we're talking more about aged care than maybe sort of independent living. And if it's possible to provide great care, brilliant care, why shouldn't that be the normal and the standard? And of course, I wrote a book about that as well, which was in a way my love letter to nursing home, to aged care, to the many staff, the majority, vast majority of staff who are caring and dedicated and go above and beyond, despite very poor pay and recognition.
They are so dedicated.
You know, so it is possible, and it's not always to do with the furnishings and the surroundings. It can be, not a modern facility, a government run facility, and it's all down to the attitudes of the staff.
Oh, it is definitely the people and the people that want to be there. You know, my mother was there like full throttle COVID. Everyone was in full, it was a PCR gear. Was it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the PPE.
Full PPE gear. You know, and every time you went to visit her, you had to have a COVID check, a test and whatever. Full on. And all the people around her were in full, all the carers, PPE gear. And, one night I was with her, it was a Friday night, and it was early on, like she'd only been there for about a week or so. And this young fellow, now it was hard to see through the gear, but I would have put him at 25, 26. She was frightened. And after she calmed down, he said to her, "Antoinette, will you dance with me?" And he just took her by the arms and down they walked. And they were dancing down the corridor. And one, I'd never seen a dance before. And two, he was just twirling her. And, I just thought, that's a gift. That guy working there, at the age of 25, that's a gift. And as time went on, when she was there, I saw him dance with many people.
And something so simple. That doesn't cost anything, does it?
I mean,
if you just have the time for that. But they need to be supported. I must admit, I spend as much time supporting and counselling the staff often as the residents. So they need to be supported to provide that care. Mm.
And there's so many stories. There's stories with the patient. There's stories with the people that work there. There's story with the visitors,
It's full of life as well.
It is.
And there are, a lot of people. We see the grim side on the news.
Do.
Or
and
we
I'm
did
sure
with the Royal
are.
Commission. Yeah. In fact, my book, the third book, The Great Escape from Woodlands Nursing Home, was published on the day that the interim report of the Royal Commission into aged care was published. But there is also, I've seen people, laugh. I've seen people flourish. They've come from home where they've neglected themselves. They've moved to an aged care facility. Mm-hmm. And with the company and the care and the medical care and regular feeding, they have absolutely flourished. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I've helped one or two to escape, if you like, and to go home again. And they're full of life and people there have had very long and interesting lives. So they make good characters.
Mm. And, there is, I don't know if it's a resurgence, but let's say a surgence of books around these subjects, around people in retirement village or nursing care, and yours are those as well. But do you think that for us, because reading is so integral in terms of how we see life, and how we see, and feel other people and show empathy and show experience and whatever, that there is, it's breaking down the barriers of aging. It's breaking down the barriers of, people in their 80s, where I think, white societies in particular have really, they haven't acknowledged it in the past, the wisdom and the life and all the wonderful things that a person can give back.
Yeah, look, I think you've hit it on the head there. Mm. Certainly about certain societies, we should be, respecting our elders and acknowledging them, shouldn't we? Mm-hmm. But I think, yes, up until fairly recently, and I think, there were a few before I got there, but, hopefully the barriers have been broken down and the stigma has been removed. So, yes, why not? Mm-hmm. You know, why not mm-hmm. set a book there as opposed to any other setting, really? The stories are there. And I think that was part of my... When doctors write, and there's quite a rich tradition, I think, of doctors as writers, one of the common themes when you look at... I'm not putting myself in the same league as Somerset Maugham or Anton Chekhov, but there's often a social issue that they're trying to address. With Chekhov, it was the Russian penal colonies, and Somerset Maugham, the slums of London, and they were writing to sort of highlight the conditions there. And in a way, I think that, you know, my books are, I don't want to, you know, smash people over the head with my message, but I want them to be a positive experience of aging, and in that way sort of smash some of the stereotypes address aging head on.
I spoke with Shankara Chandra recently, who won the Miles Franklin, and she talked about finding a place that was culturally appropriate for her mother in terms of aged care. And I was the same. You know, we put my mother into a Maronite care facility because I thought it was important. She had dementia, that there were some things around her that were familiar. And I think that's important too, to make sure that people are placed or they go to somewhere where, you know, there are people like them.
That's true. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the system could adapt to the individual rather than you having to shop around to find the place that is the most suitable, to actually provide an environment, you know, which can adapt to the resident rather than the other way around. But yes, certainly, particularly when there's language and cultural barriers like that. And, you know, I have looked after a couple of people where English is not their first language. And gradually, as they've advanced in dementia, they've lost their English. Mm. And it's very isolating when you can't communicate or there aren't staff or people who understand your mother tongue.
It is. It's very isolating. Okay, so back to your writing. Tell me how it is you first got published. When did you think, okay, I've got a book and now I'm ready to take the next step? I mean, that would have been quite nerve-wracking, I'd imagine.
It was. Even having written a first novel, which is not the one that was actually published, that's still my kind of training novel and still on my hard drive somewhere. I never had any expectation of being published. I was writing purely for myself. I thought, you know, this... I'm not just not good enough. You know, I'm not going to be one of those published writers, but I'll just do it because I've started, I can't stop. And so I started to enter some short story competitions and was, you know, getting some pleasing feedback, including winning one or two and winning residencies and things.
I mean, it's such a great entry level, isn't it?
It is. And I really encourage any new writers to do that. It gives you a bit of a portfolio of work, but it gives you a bit of feedback. It trains you to work to a word count and a deadline or whatever. But it also gives you a lot of confidence. You know, if you start to, you know, get shortlisted or placed or win those, it gives you a lot of confidence. It did with me. The very first one I won, I think I won $100. if it was the Henry Lawson Society, emerging writer. And I bought myself a case of, not obviously vintage champagne, but I bought myself a case of champagne so that if anybody ever said to me, do you make any money out of writing? I'd be able to say, well, darling, it keeps me in champagne.
Lovely.
But so from the short stories,
there,
I then had the novel and just tentatively started sending it out to, you know, join the other novels on slush piles and things, and got a few nibbles with that. But ultimately, you know, nothing came of that. I tried pitching a couple of times face to face, and that's another great thing I would encourage new writers to do. If you get the chance at a festival.
And writing courses and festivals.
Yes, all of those things. It's making contact. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, all writers are introverts, but a lot of publishers and agents are introverts, so we're all sort of equally terrified. But I think having that face-to-face, and that's exactly how I got my agent, actually. I did one of these Australian Society of Authors literary speed dating. So I had 3 minutes to pitch to the agent. And she was interested. By then, I'd actually heard back from a couple of slush piles. One was 14 months later after I'd first pitched. So, you know,
they don't have the resources really to read all through.
Is
it Rebecca Saunders who publishes you?
Rebecca Saunders is now my publisher with Hachette. And I've been so fortunate to be with the same, the same publisher with five books. And she's really done what she set out or promised that she would do, is help me to nurture my career. And now we have a great working relationship.
Joanna, well, we're out of time. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed our chat today. Thank you.
So have I. Thank you very much for having me.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.